literally true for him. The outcome of the trial. After almost a year of testimony and deliberation, the courtroom went quiet. The observers and participants in the trial were happy to leave the bombed-out city and start writing their memoirs. The participants knew they had lived and worked in a setting of extraordinary historical importance and tensions. Ursula Sherman, a research analyst at subsequent German war crimes trials, summed it up. "All of us that worked on those things went a little nuts. We used to have temper tantrums. It was one way of letting off steam. The horror kind of crept up on me during the year and after." Thoughtful observers were troubled by what the trial revealed about human nature. Brady Bryson, one of the Nuremberg attorneys, remarked, "We live in a very dangerous, vicious, wicked world, and this trial hasn't done anything at all to turn off the tap of human energy that nourishes war. Our big brain was fatally flawed because it brought together immense intellectual resources and the commitment to violence." In large organizations, there are inevitable rivalries and gossip, leaks and memoirs. But there was something else going on at Nuremberg. Sitting in that courtroom day in and day out for 10 months, listening to the horrifying testimony, viewing the appalling exhibits, and watching the defendants try to excuse their actions, there was something profoundly contaminating about all of this, and it seared the lives of all who were in attendance. Chapter 4. War Criminals with Psychiatrists and Psychologists. Nazism was a socio-cultural disease. I had at Nuremberg the purest known Nazi virus cultures, 22 clay flasks, as it were, to study. Douglas Kelly, 22 cells in Nuremberg, 1947. The flight from Mondorf-le-Bain to Nuremberg was uneventful. Robert Ley, Julius Streicher, and Hermann Göring gaped at the ruins of Nuremberg as they were being transported to their new and decidedly gloomier quarters. No longer were they in a former resort ringed by barbed wire. Now they were all in a very clear jail that held the 22 Nuremberg defendants and others who were destined for later trials. Ashcan and Dustbin, the British equivalent, had been dumped into Nuremberg. The prison was a large, cold, stone cell block with three tiers of cells, each measuring about 100 square feet. The building was musty, and the air had a staleness that one could taste. In the ensuing months, the menacing silence of the cell block was broken by the sounds of turning keys, marching guards, and Stryker's occasional screams. Two new characters who figure prominently in this book joined the Ashcan émigrés. Prisoner Rudolf Hess flew in from England, and a new prison staff member arrived, Kelly's soon-to-be nemesis, Gustav Gilbert. Rudolf Hess arrives from England. Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess had been detained in England since 1941. A gangling and shy man, he had no interests aside from the Nazi Party. Hess inspired the party faithful, spoke at mass rallies, and helped ratify the Nuremberg laws, which enabled the coming genocide. On May 10, 1941, Hess stunned the world by stealing a two-engine Messerschmitt and flying to Scotland in the hopes of persuading England to ally with Germany. Hess plummeted out of the sky dressed in a Luftwaffe uniform and landed in a field, where an astonished Scottish farmer discovered him. It was almost a scene out of Fawlty Towers, with Hess declaring to the farmer, "I have an important message for the Duke of Hamilton." The farmer didn't know what to do with him. Hess later wrote, "He helped me to get into the house, put a rocking chair near the fireplace, and offered me tea." Hess was promptly whisked off to the Tower of London, and then to a fortified country house where he stayed for a year. Finally, he was moved to Maindiff Court Military Hospital, where he was confined for 3 years. Throughout it all, Hess was under constant medical observation because of back and ankle injuries resulting from his parachute jump, as well as repeated suicide attempts, agitation, constant medical complaints, and a very odd and changeable mental status. His psychiatric records from that time are unusually extensive, and public because he requested their release, so that people in the future would learn that, in some hitherto unknown manner, people can be put into a condition which resembles hypnosis, leaving its after effects, a condition in which the persons concerned do everything that has been suggested to them, under the elimination of their own will, presumably without their being conscious of it. Hess's release of information statement gives us a hint of what the psychiatrists were dealing with. His first doctor, J. Gibson Graham, noted that Hess was instantly suspicious of his food. Hess was also known to suddenly swap plates with his guards, and sometimes he would eat only if the psychiatrist tasted his food first. Hess worried that perhaps a kitchen worker, acting for international Jewry, would try to poison him. On the other hand, he also thought that an unknown Jewish conspiracy was poisoning him when he felt good after eating. Hess complained that noises in the house or from the neighborhood were part of a plot to stop him from sleeping. Graham concluded, "He showed marked hypochondriacal paranoid tendencies, apprehension, and delusions of persecution. Simple incidents were misinterpreted and given a sinister meaning." In the course of his British confinement, Hess was seen by many psychiatrists. Psychiatrist J.R. Rees was struck by Hess's insomnia, anxiety, depression, suspiciousness, and lack of insight. "I would diagnose him as a psychopathic personality of the schizophrenic type, who is suggestible and liable to hysterical symptom formation." The next psychiatrist, Henry Dix, described Hess as a typical schizophrenic who oozed hostility and suspicion. Dix noted Hess's complaints of impaired concentration, but he had his doubts about their veracity, so he surreptitiously tested Hess's IQ by telling him that the Raven's Progressive Matrices intelligence test was just a game. Hess scored in the top 10th percentile. No problems with concentration here. Psychiatrist M.K. Johnston reported that Hess hid small pieces of paper in his room and complained that he couldn't concentrate, couldn't remember words, and had memory loss because of brain poison. Hess developed intermittent amnesia for both short-term and long-term memory. He stabbed himself in the chest and then said that Jews had tempted him to commit suicide because he was the only person who knew of their secret power of hypnosis. Johnston also reported that Hess met with an official from the Swiss embassy to insist that the embassy analyze his table wine for poison. The doctors continued, "He made a signed declaration of his desire to die, as he considers that his abominable condition is incurable. He wishes his corpse to be dressed in his flying uniform and to be sent to Germany, where on examination, poison will obviously be found." Sometimes it appeared that Hess was simulating amnesia. For instance, he couldn't define what skiing meant or remember who Shakespeare was. Certainly not typical amnesia. At times he was indifferent to the memory problems. At others, he complained bitterly that he was slipping into a fog. The doctors suggested an amytal injection to improve his memory, but Hess initially refused, stating, "I do not suffer unless I am reminded. Perhaps it is even a merciful dispensation of fate which makes me forget. If I got back my full memory, I might suffer more." Nonetheless, he did agree to one interview on May 17, 1945, when he was sedated with amytal and then interviewed by psychiatrist Henry Dix. The following excerpt gives a flavor of the amytal interview. Throughout it all, Hess merely complained of his belly pains. He didn't recover his memory in the slightest. Doctor: "What troubles you?" Patient: "Pains in my belly." Severe groans. "Oh, if only I were well. Belly ache." Groans. "Water. Water. Thirst." "You will soon have water. Tell us now what you have forgotten." "Oh, I don't know. Pain. Thirst." "You will tell us now what you have forgotten." "Water. Pain in my body. A fog." "Remember your little son's name?"
"I don't know."
"Your wife's? Ilse, is it?"
"I don't know."
"You remember your good friends, Haushofer?"
"No. Oh, bellyache. Oh, God."
"Why this pain?"
"Oh." And how you lived in Alexandria as a little boy?
No.
And all the stirring times with Adolf Hitler in Munich?
No.
You were with him in the fortress at Landisburg?
No.
Come, it will help you to tell us all that hurts you. Hess told the doctors that his body was riddled with disease, and he stuffed his pockets with homeopathic and nature cure medicines, including an elixir from a Tibetan lamasery. These weren't new symptoms. All his life he had been preoccupied with his health and diet, and he brought his own food to eat even when he dined with Hitler. After 4 years of British detention, the psychiatrists concluded that Hess was unstable in three respects. Paranoid suspicions that the British were poisoning his food and interfering with his sleep, extensive hypochondriacal preoccupations, and an amnesia that made no medical sense. Churchill agreed, commenting that, "These transcripts seem to me to consist of the outpourings of a disordered mind. They are like a conversation with a mentally defective child who has been guilty of murder or arson." All of this was superimposed on extreme eccentricity. Hess was a devotee of astrology, believed in ghosts, consulted fortune tellers, and said that he flew to Scotland because his mentor had dreamed that Hess was piloting an airplane. At best, he was extremely odd. But was he mad? That determination would have to wait until Nuremberg. On October 10, 1945, Hess flew home to a very different Germany. Gone were the adulating throngs of stormtroopers filling the immense plazas of Nuremberg. They had been replaced by ghosts and ruins. He was welcomed to Nuremberg, not by his beloved Führer, but by Warden Burton Andrus. Hess promptly handed Andrus packets of his food and chocolates, and demanded that they be analyzed for poison. Throughout his long detention, Hess's memory would come and go. Was there a method to his madness? Gustav Gilbert arrives. Because Douglas Kelly spoke little German, a prison officer named John Dolebois translated for him at Mondorf-les-Bains and Nuremberg. Dolebois was an easygoing, likable interpreter, but he was anxious to move on. He was succeeded on October 23, 1945, by psychologist Lieutenant Gustav Mahler Gilbert, a dour man on a mission. Born in New York to a poor Austrian Jewish emigre family, Gilbert was raised in an orphanage, attended the City College of New York, and completed his doctorate in psychology at Columbia with a special focus on social psychology. He had studied the Rorschach briefly at Columbia, but was not particularly interested in it. Before his Nuremberg assignment, Gilbert had been working in the army interrogating POWs. His German was superb and proper, and he was determined to ferret out those who were responsible for the Nazi war crimes. He regarded the Nuremberg assignment as an opportunity to write history's most perfectly controlled experiment in social pathology. Kelly and Gilbert had different strengths and approaches. Kelly viewed his Nuremberg position as yet another interesting assignment, complementing his vast clinical and forensic experience. The Nazi prisoners were interesting to him, but they were, after all, just more prisoners. Kelly was, however, intellectually stimulated by the challenge of his job and was troubled by the Nazis. Colonel Kelly viewed Lieutenant Gilbert as his interpreter and assistant, particularly since Gilbert was replacing Dolebois and Kelly outranked him. Gilbert's perspective didn't coincide at all with Kelly's. To him, the Nazi defendants were the devil incarnate, and he viewed his task not as Kelly's interpreter, but as an interrogator who criticized the prisoners for their moral failings. In addition to his job as interpreter, Gilbert was given an ambiguous assignment by Warden Andrus. He was to be the warden's eyes and ears among the prisoners. Gilbert and the warden had a fraught relationship. Although Gilbert was not insubordinate to Andrus, he conveyed disdain, particularly when Andrus offered his own peculiar ideas about the prisoners' psyches. The interactions got so bad that Andrus wanted to transfer Gilbert from Nuremberg, but Kelly dissuaded him, while also warning Gilbert to mend fences with the warden. The ambiguous responsibilities and reporting relationship between Kelly and Gilbert also aggravated their interactions. Kelly was a Rorschach expert but spoke little German. Gilbert was fluent in German, but was not very knowledgeable about the Rorschach. Kelly was dispassionate and sardonic. Gilbert was intense and humorless. Kelly was from an affluent, long-established California family. Gilbert was raised in poverty in New York as the child of recent immigrants. One night over dinner, Kelly and Gilbert talked about the prisoners in their care and decided to write a book based on their observations. As a first step, Kelly suggested that Gilbert take notes about each interview. Gilbert felt that taking notes in the prisoner's presence would inhibit the conversation, so he did the best he could to reconstruct the interactions and gave Kelly a copy of his notes. At that point, he had no reason to suspect Kelly's motivations. Lobbying for scientific study. For many years, I wondered what Kelly and Gilbert were doing at Nuremberg and if there was another explanation for how they got there. Library special collections and archives are like neighborhood estate sales. You never know what you will find. Working in the vaults of the Library of Congress, I chanced upon microfilmed correspondence among academics, intelligence officers, and Nuremberg prosecutors. The documents proposed studying the war criminals' psyches with Rorschach tests. On June 11, 1945, Dr. John Millett of New York wrote to Justice Jackson on behalf of a group of renowned professors, Alvin Barak, Carl Binger, Richard Brickner, Frank Fremont Smith, Adolf Meyer, Tracy Putnam, and George Stevenson, who represented a remarkably diverse group of professional societies. In 1945, all of these disparate groups were convinced that the brains of executed Nazi leaders should be studied. It was a decidedly unusual letter. The trial had not yet started, but the academics were already recommending that the prisoners be executed in such a fashion that their brains could be studied post-mortem. In addition, the letter specifically requested that the prisoners be tested with a Rorschach. Detailed knowledge of the personality of these leaders would be valuable as a guide to those concerned with the reorganization and re-education of Germany. In addition to the psychiatric interviews, it would be desirable to make a number of psychological tests, such as the Rorschach. If and when the accused has been convicted and sentenced to death, it would be desirable to have a detailed autopsy, especially of the brain. Therefore, it is urged that the convicted be shot in the chest, not in the head. Signed, John Millett. Millett's letter was followed 3 days later by a letter from OSS agent Sheldon Gluck to General Donovan, urging that a psychiatric panel of experts be appointed at Nuremberg. A chief aim of the trial will be to convince posterity of the facts and to interpret those facts and the entire Nazi leadership from the points of view of law, medicine, and sociology. For the first time in history, a thorough scientific study of the types of mentality possessed by German military, political, and industrial insiders will be made. Gluck also urged that Rorschach experts be included in the panel. It may seem peculiar that there was so much interest in testing the defendants with the Rorschach, but in the 1940s, the Rorschach test was the psychological test. The Swiss psychiatrist Hermann Rorschach, 1884 to 1922, observed that patients would project their fantasies and concerns onto a neutral, ambiguous inkblot card. Rorschach also noted that the inkblot test could provide a rough guide to how patients approached tasks cognitively. A brain scan, so to speak, long before such things were technologically possible. Its ability to map what was on a person's mind made it a useful adjunct to psychiatric evaluations at a time when the field focused heavily on the unconscious, and its unstructured nature lent itself to evaluating patients who were noticeably guarded or uncooperative. Thus, its inclusion as a core component in the psychological evaluation of the Nuremberg war criminals was entirely logical. The correspondence file about the psychological testing is voluminous. Donovan wrote Jackson the very next day supporting Gluck's proposal, and on June 23rd, Jackson replied to Millett with cautious support. He agreed that Millett's proposal had merit, but worried that psychiatric assessments might be prejudicial to the trial if they were performed before a determination of guilt. It is not unlikely that their lawyers would demand production of the reports. The result might easily be that we would be compelled to litigate or discuss questions of the mental condition of the defendants, as to which it is conceivable your group would be in disagreement among themselves. Rumors of a most troublesome kind might grow that we were preparing an insanity defense. Jackson agreed that such assessments might be made after the verdicts were in. I also think that if the defective mentalities and abnormalities and perversions of these people were scientifically ascertained and laid before the world, it would be helpful in preventing coming generations of Germans from building up a myth that they were supermen. Responding to Millett's request for sparing the defendants' brains, Jackson concluded, "As to your suggestion that a victim be shot in the chest and not in the head, I would say that the general attitude of the army is that those who are subjected to death sentence as criminals should be hanged rather than shot, as the hanging seems to carry with it an implication of dishonor." On August 16, 1945, Millett wrote back to Jackson, volunteering to suggest experts whenever Jackson was ready for them. Jackson replied 1 month later, thanking Millett for his advice, and noting that, "To have in a small space in a common jail a little group of men who have been able to exert such an evil influence upon the whole world is a rare experience." But he cautioned, "They are undergoing interrogations, and as you know, numerous examinations or interrogations are upsetting to them." In the meantime, circumstances changed, and Jackson realized that he would indeed need psychiatric examinations on some of the defendants, not for the sake of history or science, but because of concerns about their fitness for trial. Thus, he wrote Millett on October 12, 1945, requesting specific names of experts. In an interesting aside, Jackson revealed both the urgency of his request as well as his understanding that getting multiple scientific societies to agree on such a list rapidly was not very likely. "If it is not possible for you to suggest these names as the official suggestion of the committee, I would much appreciate your own advice as to names, for the reason that I may have to act very suddenly and without opportunity for adequate consultation." The Urgent Problem, Dealing with Hess. Hess's mental status was the likely precipitant for Jackson's change of course regarding psychological testing. His amnesia and paranoia were becoming such a problem that Douglas Kelly wrote to Warden Andrus suggesting an Amatol interview. Kelly acknowledged that there had been rare fatalities with such interviews, but stated that in his experience with over 1,000 cases, he had never seen a major adverse effect. Jackson denied Kelly's request because of the small but potential risks from Amatol, although he noted that if Hess had been his family member, he would have been inclined to follow Kelly's suggestion. 5 days later, General Donovan requested that the court appoint a commission to inquire into his, Hess's, state of mental health, as well as his ability to confer with his counsel in the preparation of his defense. In December 1945, the tribunal decided to allow examination of the defendants by qualified psychiatrists who wished to make purely scientific investigations unconnected with any issue in the trial. By then, however, Kelly and Gilbert had completed their Rorschach studies, so the authorization was a moot point. In June 1946, Millett wrote to Justice Jackson once more to say that there was no need to send over a group of psychiatrists to conduct extensive studies of the prisoners, given Kelly's credentials and observations, but he wondered whether there would be sufficient psychiatrists and psychologists on hand to observe the prisoners between the day of verdict and their presumable execution. One senses that Jackson was becoming exasperated when he replied, reminding Millett that an adequate number of psychiatrists and psychologists were already on hand, and that the anticipated period between day of sentencing and day of execution would probably be so brief that if Millett wanted additional experts, they would need to be ready on short notice. The Alliance Between the Intelligence Community and Psychology. I read these various letters with a sense of incredulity. They reveal the surprisingly cordial relationship among psychology, psychiatry, and the intelligence community. In 1945, everyone noted the Nazi regime's fascination and preoccupation with death and killing, fires and flaying, almost as if that was a goal in itself. As a result, there was a sense of common purpose between academe and government that is unimaginable today. German psychoanalytic émigrés such as Erich Fromm and Frieda Reichmann, as well as social philosophers like Theodor Adorno and Herbert Marcuse, wrote extensively about the Nazi psyche even before the war started. Sociologists such as Talcott Parsons helped with morale efforts, and anthropologists like Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson were hired to help explain national character, enemy cultures, and to assist with white propaganda to bolster domestic morale, and black propaganda to undermine the enemy's morale. Psychoanalytic thinking regarded toilet training and infant swaddling heavily shaped their discourse. Harvard historian William Langer headed the research and analysis branch of the OSS. This forerunner of the Central Intelligence Agency was heavily stocked with psychiatrists and psychologists. Langer's brother Walter was a psychoanalyst who co-authored a classified psychological analysis of Adolf Hitler, with Harvard psychologist Henry Murray, Ernst Criss of the New School for Social Research, and Bertram Lewin of the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. The War Department's special project branch was headed by Murray Bernays, a young lawyer who had married Sigmund Freud's niece. This was clearly not a time when the social sciences stood in opposition to the government. On the contrary, the developing American social sciences and the OSS were so intertwined that it was hardly surprising when the intelligence services expressed interest in testing the Nuremberg prisoners. Finally, General Donovan had a long track record of interest in psychological analysis throughout the war, and he brought those interests with him when he arrived in Nuremberg. His agency had embraced many sensible psychological goals, analyzing propaganda, supporting morale, inferring the enemy's motivation and goals, establishing screening procedures for new recruits, as well as some less sensible ideas like launching incendiary bats at the enemy's cities or drugging Hitler's vegetable garden to alter his behavior. The routine use of psychiatry in prison settings. In most Western countries, prison officials are concerned about the mental health of their detainees, even those on death row. Although the purpose of imprisonment is to detain and punish, the state also provides some medical and mental health care to prisoners. It doesn't want them to escape via illness or suicide. As Warden Andrus put it, a guy could go nuts sitting in a little cell with what some of these boys have got on their minds. So Nuremberg was not particularly unusual for having prison chaplains, morale and welfare officers, and psychiatrists on staff. Even though the detainees were facing likely execution, their well-being was closely monitored. For instance, Kelly had recommended a prison library and exercise time for the prisoners. Andrus initially thought this was coddling them, but subsequently agreed with the idea. The psychiatrists and psychologists were also responsible for ensuring that the prisoners were fit for trial and could cooperate with their defense counsel. For a handful of defendants, this was not an assured thing. The industrialist Gustav Krupp had already been excused from prosecution because of his age and senility. Other prisoners were deeply depressed and had attempted suicide. In fact, Leonardo Conti had already hung himself in the Nuremberg jail. All were aware that something was wrong with Hess. The tribunal worried that he was starving himself to death because of his suspicions that the Allies were giving him brain poisons, and his memory problems raised questions of his ability to assist in his own defense. The judges appointed an international panel to assess his fitness for trial. Kelly and Gilbert had their hands full dealing with the interpersonal frictions between Stryker and the other defendants. Stryker was so, well, creepy, that the court appointed a panel to assess his fitness for trial, too. As a result, international experts were also summoned to verify Stryker's fitness for trial. Goering was straightforward from a forensic perspective. In his case, there was no hint of diminished capacity. Kelly's special examinations. Douglas Kelly was one of the few individuals to have completely unfettered access to the prisoners. He and his interpreter, John Dolebois, set about visiting them daily. Dolebois did favors for the Nazis, such as helping them communicate with their wives. The Nazis thus welcomed Dolebois's presence during the psychiatric interviews and testing sessions, and his presence, if anything, facilitated Kelly's interviews. Kelly later claimed to have spent 80 hours with each prisoner, but he may have stretched things a bit. He clearly did spend an enormous amount of time with Goering, but it is hard to believe that he could have spent 80 hours with each of the 22 Nuremberg defendants. After all, the defendants arrived in Nuremberg on August 12, 1945, and Kelly left in January 1946. Kelly's gift of gab helped him with the prisoners. In his writings, he stated that he considered them all desk murderers, buccaneers, and careerists. But in interacting with them, he kept those thoughts to himself and was not judgmental or critical. The prisoners were accustomed to frequent interrogation about what they had done. Kelly's questions, however, were different. He wanted to understand them as people, and the prisoners enjoyed his visits. In addition to Kelly's formal role in the prison, he had a personal agenda. He would characterize the war criminals' minds by testing their IQ and by administering the most powerful psychological test of the day, the Rorschach. Gustav Gilbert's role. Gustav Gilbert entered Nuremberg as Dolebois' replacement in late October 1945, and he could not have been more different. Dolebois wanted out of Nuremberg. He had other aspirations for his final years of military service. On the other hand, Gustav Gilbert desperately wanted in at Nuremberg to study and characterize the depravity of the Nazi leadership. In the beginning, Kelly and Gilbert appeared to work together satisfactorily, but they had an enormously different interpersonal style. Kelly, with his easygoing blarney, contrasted with Gilbert with his intensity and efficiency. In their writings, one senses profound differences in terms of how the Nazis affected them. Kelly found the Nazis to be interesting specimens and relished telling stories about them to the news media. One doesn't get the sense that he lost sleep over his interactions with the Nazis. Gilbert didn't find them interesting in Kelly's dispassionate way, but loathed them and told them so. There were other differences as well. Kelly had an enormous amount of clinical experience and expressed sympathy for the many GIs he treated for combat exhaustion. Gilbert was less sympathetic to the troops, describing them years later as misfit soldiers. The men's differences in style and temperament were exemplified in their vacation plans over the Christmas holidays in 1945. Kelly went off on vacation, pure and simple. Gilbert traveled to Dachau to interview concentration camp guards who were awaiting execution. With these varied styles, they appealed to different prisoners, some liking Kelly's easygoing manner, others appreciating Gilbert's serious formality. Kelly noted that the prisoners were eager to talk. "Seldom have I found psychiatric interviews so easy as were most of these. They talked almost without probing or prompting." He commented that Hess kept his distance, but that Goering was positively jovial over my daily comings and wept unashamedly when I left Nuremberg for the States. Advising the prosecution. There was no doctor-patient confidentiality at Nuremberg. Both Kelly and Gilbert advised the prison administration, Warden Andrus, and the prosecution, Justice Jackson, regarding prisoner interactions and some of the defense strategies planned by the defendants' legal teams. They even suggested prosecutorial strategy. Kelly wrote Donovan telling him that Goering claimed to have a particular friendship for General Donovan, and stated flatly that the general and myself are the only two individuals in the world in whom he really had any confidence. In the same note, Kelly warned Donovan that Balder von Schirach was now parroting statements of Goering to the effect that, "Of course in the courtroom we must present a united front." Not to be outdone, Gilbert also routinely advised the prosecution. One commentator describes him rather uncharitably as rooting around like a truffle pig for gobbets of intelligence. The psychological assessment. Kelly and Gilbert supplemented their interviews with psychological tests. Gilbert modified the Wechsler-Bellevue intelligence scale for use in German, and Kelly oversaw the Rorschach administration to characterize the prisoners' thinking and motivation. When Gilbert was unavailable, Kelly brought along another interpreter. Because the prison cells were so small, they would sit on the prisoners' cots, with the prisoner sandwiched between them. The IQ scores reveal a range of intelligence, from Julius Streicher at 106, all the way to Hjalmar Schacht at 143. The prisoners proudly compared their scores, like American high school students talking about their SATs. After he left Nuremberg, Kelly was interviewed by the New Yorker and asked about the prisoners' intelligence. "I didn't find any geniuses. Goering, for example, though with an IQ of 138, he's pretty good, but no wizard." Kelly's comments about the prisoners' IQs are amusing, because, of course, he was a bona fide genius, certified as such by Lewis Terman himself. Many of the prisoners were enchanted by the Rorschach testing. Goering expressed regret that the Luftwaffe had not had available such excellent testing techniques. Kelly and Gilbert shared an office, and they rounded on their prisoners both together and separately. There is no indication that they quarreled about the testing or the translation of the war criminals' responses. For unclear reasons, some of the prisoners completed the Rorschach repeatedly, sometimes with Kelly and sometimes with Gilbert. With time, Gilbert started to feel that he was doing the lion's share of the work, writing up the notes from their interviews and giving Kelly copies. Both were ambitious men who realized the importance of the topic and how later publication could influence their personal careers. Both have also been accused of exaggerating their assessments of the prisoners for later fame and fortune. Kelly departs. On February 6, 1946, Kelly left Nuremberg. He hadn't seen his wife since 1942 and wanted to get home. He was also eager to begin writing his book about the Nazi mind. Psychiatrist Leon Goldenson succeeded him at Nuremberg. People had different views about Kelly's departure. Warden Andrus had resented Kelly's self-promoting interviews with the press and maintained that the glare of the limelight had intoxicated him. With his characteristic verve, Kelly was superb in interviews and left reporters with memorable lines, though sometimes their veracity was questionable. He told reporters that he practically lived with Hess, and that Goering took his pain pills like peanuts, throwing them in his mouth as he read or talked. Kelly described Goering to the press as dominant, aggressive, merciless, yet a jovial extrovert capable of occasional tenderness. He reported that Hitler had surrounded himself with yes men, and that Goering had responded that all the no men are 6 feet under. This was how to talk to a reporter. On September 6, 1946, Warden Andrus complained to the War Department about Kelly. He left here under more or less of a cloud because it had been suspected that he was giving information to newspaper reporters in violation of security regulations, and worse than that, in violation of policies expressed by the tribunal and in disobedience of orders. Andrus was particularly furious about an interview Kelly gave to the London Sunday Express on August 25, 1946, and noted ruefully, "Since Dr. Kelly has been separated from the service, I am not familiar with what action can be taken, but I am reporting this in the hope that something can be done. The enclosed article in almost every line violates the policies of International Military Tribunal and constitutes a complete breach of trust. In addition to that, from the words he put into the mouths of the accused, I am satisfied that for the most part, he is misquoting them." The Sunday Express article's subheadings give a flavor of Kelly's show-and-tell tone that so infuriated Andrus and others. "Hitler's stomach the cause of all the trouble, when Ribbentrop wanted a medal. Why Hitler delayed marriage." Although Andrus was pleased by Kelly's departure, most of the prisoners were sad to see him go. Indeed, on December 26, 1945, Alfred Rosenberg, former Reich Minister of the Occupied Eastern Territories, wrote Kelly, "I regret your departure from Nuremberg, as do the comrades confined with me. I thank you for your humane behavior and also for your attempt to understand our reasons. I wish you luck in your later life." For a while, it appeared that luck would indeed be with Kelly, but his inner demons chased him down. Part 3. Faces of Malice. Chapter 5. Defendant Robert Lay, Bad Brain. I had the spiritual responsibility for peace of labor, production of the factories, and confidence of the worker to the system of National Socialism. It has been proved that I accomplished my task. Until the 1st May 1945, there was neither a strike nor reports of sabotage. To the contrary, the production of armament showed a steady rise, even among foreign labor. I cannot think of a better vote of confidence. Robert Lay, Autobiographic Statement, 1945. The Nazi foreign labor policy was a policy of mass deportation and mass enslavement, of underfeeding and overworking foreign laborers, of subjecting them to every form of degradation, brutality, and inhumanity. Thomas Dodd, Prosecutor, Testimony on Forced Labor at Nuremberg, December 11, 1945. The Choice. Every one of the Nuremberg defendants was uniquely compelling. It was difficult for me to choose which defendants to discuss in this book, but ultimately I settled on four who were poles apart in terms of their backgrounds and behaviors. We have met them in chapters 2 and 4, and now it is time to describe each in turn at greater length. What were they like while in power? What did Kelly and Gilbert make of them in prison? What were their fates in front of the tribunal? Why these four? Two of them, Rudolf Hess and Julius Streicher, raised so many psychiatric flags that the tribunal formally requested their psychiatric evaluation. Robert Lay killed himself in prison, and after examining his brain, researchers theorized that his malice was driven by brain pathology. Hermann Göring was quite simply the principal defendant and highest-ranking Nazi official. I have chosen to present them in the order of their deaths, and thus start with Robert Lay, one of the most complex defendants, who is all but forgotten, but shouldn't be. May we have his brain? When Robert Lay hung himself in 1945, he had no way of knowing that he had fulfilled the wishes of multiple American academic societies that had written to Justice Robert Jackson, requesting the brains of the war criminals. As noted in Chapter 4, their letter requested, if and when the accused has been convicted and sentenced to death, it would be desirable to have a detailed autopsy, especially of the brain. Therefore, it is urged that the convicted be shot in the chest, not in the head. Of all the war criminals, only Lay gratified their wish, and his brain was meticulously examined. The rest of the executed war criminals were cremated, taking the secrets of their brains with them. An old and established medical tradition links malice to brain injury. Bad brains, if you will. It comes as no surprise that this neural explanation was a prominent sentiment at Nuremberg, particularly in the case of Robert Lay. In his instance, there was both a history of major head injury and a certifiably abnormal brain. Lay's background. Robert Lay held the benign-sounding position of head of the German Labor Front, which controlled 95% of German workers. In that capacity, he ordered the murder of union activists who did not support the Nazi party line and helped set up slave labor factories throughout Germany. He was also indicted for his propaganda activities. He ranted against the Catholic Church and, like many in the party, edited an anti-Semitic newspaper. He wrote, "Degenerate to their very bones, nauseatingly corrupt, and cowardly like all nasty creatures, such is the aristocratic clique which the Jew has sicked on National Socialism. We must exterminate this filth, extirpate it root and branch." On another occasion he wrote, "Sure, the Jew is also a person, but the flea is also an animal, only not a very pleasant one. And since the flea is not a pleasant animal, we don't see it as our duty to watch over and protect it, to allow it to flourish so that it can stick and pain and torture us. Rather, we must render it harmless. And so it is with Jews." Lay was born in 1890 into a large but poor farming family in the Rhine province. As mentioned in Chapter 2, he sustained a major head injury in World War I. The injury left him with a stammer for the rest of his life. Following World War I, he led an erratic life, drinking heavily, but despite this, he returned to university and obtained a PhD, magna cum laude, in chemistry. He worked briefly for the IG Farben Chemical Corporation, but was fired because of his drinking and his Nazi political activities. In later years, he remembered his Farben days and encouraged Hitler to use lethal chemical weapons in the war. Ley was fanatically loyal to Hitler and regarded the Nazi Party as our religious order, our home. Without it, we cannot live. Hitler was his messiah, the Jew was his devil, and World War II was a titanic apocalyptic struggle of good versus evil. To win that war, Germany needed a harmonious and united country. Ley was a major propagandist for the party. After the war, the Associated Press noted some of his aphorisms. On war. War is a blessing of God. It is the expression of the highest and best in manhood. On America. Hate, hate, hate. Every German must hate the gangsters, the murderers, the assassins, who come from the center of world Jewry and capitalism, the United States of America. In this war, there can be no compromise with these half-breed Americans who come across the sea to slay in a war that does not concern them. He politicked at international labor conferences, praising National Socialism as a workers' paradise, but his foreign relations missions were not particularly successful. While attending one international labor meeting, he got more drunk than usual and alienated the Latin American delegations by saying that they looked as though someone had lured them out of the jungle with bananas. Dismissed by others in the party as a laughable bugaboo and an eccentric idealist, Ley had a goal of creating a reliable and loyal German workforce. If the workers cooperated, he would do everything in his power to assure their comfort. He was the workers' champion, and he advocated for equal pay for women workers, for mandatory vacation time, and for hiring more workers rather than forcing others to work overtime. He campaigned for better housing, humane working conditions, and for strength through joy. To support this last goal, he set up a travel agency for workers and provided generous, inexpensive vacation benefits that were wildly popular. 85% of German workers used them to take cruises on the Rhine or vacations on the North Sea beaches. Ley even bought a cruise ship for workers, modestly renaming it the Robert Ley. He helped establish the Volkswagen as the people's car and championed building with prefabricated materials. According to Ley, a happy worker would be a productive worker, and all of these extensive benefits would be provided under the watchful and protective eye of the Gestapo. Other Nazi leaders were jealous of his expanding power and skeptical of the value of all of these worker benefits. Goering, for instance, sniffed, "The labor front should make more strength and less joy." On the flip side of the coin, Ley was not just a benign futurist, but a ferocious fighter for the party. If the workers did not cooperate, if they went on strike, for instance, or opposed the party, they would be removed. He was quite capable of treachery when it came to controlling the workforce. His ruthlessness was evident early on in dealing with labor leaders who opposed the party. On May Day 1933, the Nazi Party honored workers with parades and fireworks. The next day, the Nazis pounced, seizing union buildings, arresting union leaders, freezing union bank accounts, and closing union newspapers. Many other instances of Ley's brutality were notable. When the Allies breached the German borders, Ley and Goebbels created a werewolf battalion to fight a guerrilla war in Germany against the invaders and carry out sabotage and assassinations, ultimately killing between 3,000 and 5,000 people. Ley was a complex man. While living extravagantly, he always remembered growing up in poverty and focused his efforts on improving the morale of the underclass. "There is nothing more degrading and humiliating for someone," he said, "than when he recognizes that he is without value in human society." He flew into frequent violent rages and was even more corrupt than usual for the Nazi leadership. His drinking problems were legendary. In 1937, he drunkenly careened around Munich with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor in tow. as one of his aides later recounted, he drove the car through the locked gates and then raced up and down at full speed between the barracks, scaring hell out of the workers and nearly running over several. The next day, Hitler told Goering to take over the Duke's visit before Ley killed him. As Ley's limitations became clearer to the Nazi leadership, Albert Speer assumed many of his functions. Ley in prison. The Americans captured Ley in May 1945. He bristled at being described as a war criminal and complained that it was illegal to apply international laws retroactively. "I don't see how you can make a law after things have been done. Even God first made the Ten Commandments and judged the people by them afterward." While awaiting trial in Nuremberg, he told Kelly and Gilbert, "Stand us against a wall and shoot us. Well and good, you are victors. But why should I be brought before a tribunal like a criminal? I can't even get the word out." Writing his lawyer, he continued in the same vein, "I understand that the victor thinks he has to exterminate and destroy his hated opponents. I am not defending myself against being shot or killed. I am defending myself, and with every right, against being branded as a criminal and against a procedure without any legal foundation based on pure caprice. I am a German and a National Socialist, but I am no criminal." In his prison interrogations, Ley was surprisingly open and insightful when he talked about the Nazi defeat. On September 1, 1945, he said, "I wish to say at this time that one thing broke us, not only externally but within ourselves. We had the belief that the will of the human being was omnipotent and that we did not need the compassion of heaven. The catastrophe, that is, defeat, taught us different." Ley's interrogations revealed a curious melange of remorse, insight, and astonishing misjudgment. He reported that in his cell he had been talking about the war with his dead wife, and thought that the Jews would pardon him if only he could talk with Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann. He wanted to form a committee of anti-Semites and Jews, and getting carried away with the idea, wanted to establish a non-anti-Semitic Nazi party in the United States. Interrogations of Ley were difficult because he was hard to understand, not just because of his stammer, but also because he was so excitable and uninhibited. The interpreter John Dolebois noted that Ley would jump up off his chair, wave his arms, pace, and shout at least 3 times during each interview. Kelly commented that Ley was totally unable to carry on a coherent conversation without starting a ranting speech. He would stand, then pace the floor, throw out his arms, gesticulate more and more violently, and begin to shout. An interrogator at Nuremberg asked Ley about how the Nazi party was organized, and Ley went off on a tangent, describing his mystical ideas about the nature of the state and the importance of blood, race, being, energy, and power. I quote excerpts from his response because there is something not quite right about the flow of associations, something that the Ashcan observers had noted months earlier. "The higher a people is placed, the more needs it has. Naturally, it has various needs, like the needs of labor, traffic, and culture organizations. Many organizational positions are required. The important thing at first is to find out the basic substance of the nation, the feeling of the national, the blood, the race, the being, and the historical background of the nation. Comparing it with the laws of energy, it is just like one big field of power. One has to recognize these powers oneself, and one can recognize them better when one has lived through the procedure and being of the people. The state is a concept that was founded by the people in order to satisfy their needs, and the people always looked upon the state as its partner, as its party." 1 week later, Ley was questioned about his accomplishments. In the following transcript, he omits describing how, as